MacCast, Sunday, March 3rd, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Once again, glad to be back here with you for another week of Apple Mac news, technology talk, just hanging out, right? I like hanging out with you. It's fun to get together every week and go over the latest things that are going on in our community. And I hope you are having a great day, week, whatever it might be. And we certainly have a lot of things to get into in this episode. No shortage of stuff to talk about. We're going to be talking about USB and the new standard, which might not seem so new, or it's actually maybe the older standards are looking newer. I don't know. We're going to get into those details. It's all confusing, but we'll try to sort it out for you. We're going to talk about upgraders, people upgrading smartphones and what they're likely to choose. Talk a little bit about Apple Music, possibly in a place where you might not expect it, or again, maybe not. Some changes going on over on Apple's car project. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple's thinking on this whole new foldable thing. Talk about what Apple is doing with next generation Apple Watch and maybe some sleep related stuff, and also streaming music, rounding out the news for this week. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback on some of the latest things we've been talking about, Apple's modular designs, maybe of the Mac Pro, talk about Apple retail experiences. And then it seems like this happens quite frequently, but we get kind of into themes in different weeks. And this week, the theme turned out to be encryption and securing our data and privacy in the cloud, or maybe even locally at home. So we're going to talk about encryption and privacy and those sorts of things, and then round things out with a question about reinstalling iOS. So that should fill out this episode quite nicely. It is going to be a good one, so hang in. I think we'll just jump right in this week to kind of our first story, talking about USB 3.2, the new USB. Well, maybe the old new USB is new again. I don't really know. It's all very confusing, because if USB 3.0 and 3.1 were not confusing enough, the USB Implementers Forum, USBIF, has decided to muddy the waters, it looks like, a little bit further with the release of USB 3.2. Because when they do that, they're actually going to rebrand USB 3.0 and 3.1 under new technological monikers, all under the name of USB 3.2. So we're going to have three flavors now of USB 3.2. Really, the two old ones, USB 3.0 and 3.1, renamed, and then the actual new, what I'm going to call real USB 3.2. So let's see if we can kind of decipher this for you. Try to follow along. I had to like map this out, and luckily the good folks over at Tom's Hardware kind of laid this all out, which is where I got my information. So you can check out the article over there if you want to really dive into it. But basically, USB 3.1 Generation 1, that's what we have now, which was the former USB 3.0, the stuff that runs at 5 gigabits per second. That is now going to be rebranded as USB 3.2 Generation 1. So 3.0 became 3.1 Gen 1. It is now 3.2 Gen 1, 5 gigabits per second. All right, that's the first level. Then you have USB 3.1 Gen 2, which was USB 3.1, really, 10 gigabits per second. That is going to become, you guessed it, USB 3.2 Generation 2. All right, and then you might be thinking, oh, great, well, that means USB 3.2, the real USB 3.2, will just be USB 3.2 Gen 3? Nope, not quite. USB 3.2 will technically be known as USB 3.2 Gen 2x2, because it runs at 20 gigabits per second. So that's it. And just to clarify things even further, and by clarify, I mean totally confuse things, each one of these flavors is going to get its own brand new marketing term. So super speed USB will be the first tier. So that will be USB 3.2 Generation 1, or USB 3. Super speed USB 10 gigabits per second is the old 3.1, which, as you know now, is the new rebranded USB 3.2 Gen 2. And then super speed USB 20 gigabits per second is your new USB 3.2 or USB 3.2 Gen 2x2. I'm assuming it's 2x2. It's 2x2, so I'm assuming that's 2x2, right? So did that clear everything up? No, probably not. Probably just got a little more confusing. Luckily, though, the connector isn't changing with USB 3.2 Gen 2x2 because it's only possible over USB Type-C connectors. So the very latest version of USB, the 20 gigabits per second stuff, does run over a USB Type-C connector exclusively. So you, at least you know if you're using USB Type-C, you will ultimately be able to support the latest and greatest flavor of USB, USB 3.2. I guess technically they're all USB 3.2, and I believe all of them will run over a Type-C connector at this point, but I don't know. What do you think of all this, right? It's confusing. Maybe we should just all stick with Thunderbolt, although even there, we got USB Type-C connectors, so single port, I thought, was supposed to make everything easy, seems to be making things a little bit more confusing, because we really won't know very well what we're plugging in. At least, it'll probably just work. So we have that. Security researchers at the Network and Distributed Systems Security Symposium actually revealed a security flaw that was recently discovered in Thunderbolt 3, speaking of that connectivity. They are calling this thing Thunderclap, and basically it is an exploit that is done by misusing how Thunderbolt functions. And in doing that, a malicious device has the capability to access your system memory without any oversight from the operating system. The issue is that Thunderbolt peripherals and accessories are effectively considered to be trusted components when you connect to them, and therefore they have kinds of, you know, higher level access than most other things, and therefore that can be exploited. Now, there actually is one possible defense for this called input-output memory management units, and that can help because it forces devices to only access memory required for a task and block off everything else. Mac OS, as it turns out, is the only operating system to actually use IOMMU out of the box. So Macs have a little bit of an advantage here, but it doesn't mean that they are fully immune from this exploit. So the exploit does require physical access, and that means your best defense is to avoid plugging in random or untrusted peripherals or cables into your Mac's Thunderbolt connector. So as long as you're doing that, you're probably going to be safe. I don't think there's a huge security threat here, but it is one that exists, and hopefully Apple will be taking additional steps to try and secure things in the future now that this has been, you know, thrown out into, well, not into the wild, but it's been discovered. As far as we know, there aren't currently any things exploiting this in the wild, but they could be coming now that the research is out there. It's always that cat and mouse game, and hopefully Apple will jump right on top of it and take some additional security measures to close things up if they can. You know, it's, I don't know much about this stuff, so I don't know how technically challenging that will be, but Apple has a lot of really smart security people on their staff, so I'm sure if there's a way to shut it down, they will figure it out. We've talked quite a bit recently about the slowing upgrade cycle for smartphones, and it has been a bit gloomy for Apple as iPhone sales have been trailing off, but now it looks like there might be a little bit of a bright spot for Apple in a recent survey. More folks than ever seem to be looking to upgrade their smartphones in the next 2 months, and of those planning to upgrade, many of them are likely to pick up an iPhone. This is data from a survey by Robert W. Baird of 1,500 U.S. shoppers. They found that 15% of the people they talked to said they plan to buy a new smartphone in the next few months, and not only that, about 67% of them said that they plan to purchase an iPhone, and of those surveyed, a majority of them said they did have their current device for more than 2 years. So that sort of confirms what we've already known the trend to be, that people are upgrading their devices less frequently. But now that you have a larger percentage of people with older devices, they are probably looking to upgrade, and they are likely to choose an iPhone. Now, the same survey wasn't quite as positive on Apple's prospects for its new video subscription service. They talked to folks about that as well. And of those surveyed, only about 18% of them said they would be interested in subscribing to a video service from Apple. What's interesting about that part of this survey, and something I'm curious about, is it made it sound like they were asking if people would be willing to pay for a subscription to an Apple video service, and it's not clear that that is the type of service that Apple is going to bring out. I think a lot of people, if you ask them, myself included, about buying another video subscription service, people are already tapped out, right? We already subscribe to a lot of things. Many of us have multiple subscription services. I know myself, I have HBO, I have Netflix, I have Hulu now, because I got that on the Black Friday special, so it was only $12 for the first year. But had it not been that price, had it been their standard price, and I think they just did reduce it to $5.99 for the ad-supported stuff, I likely still wouldn't have bought into Hulu, right? It's just a little bit too much. And if Apple comes out with a new service and asks me to pay $15-$20 a month, I'm going to be hard-pressed to really justify that, especially considering the fact that I think they only have a few dozen of their own original shows in the works. And I'm not sure that's enough content for me, especially given things like Amazon Prime and Netflix and HBO, which I have lots of shows I'm already enjoying from them. So I'm already at kind of saturation for a lot of my video content. And, you know, it's going to be hard to justify paying more for another service. And you've got Disney on the way, Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars. I'm likely to give up one of my subscription services to switch, but I don't know that I would continue to just keep adding additional ones. So it really, again, doesn't surprise me that that number was low, but I think Apple isn't thinking about its video subscription service in that way. I think they are going to likely go the route where they will have a free tier, and anybody who owns an Apple device is going to get access to that. It's going to help drive probably Apple TV sales, but also it's going to bring more people into the TV app where Apple can work on signing folks up for the premium channels that they're going to partner with. That's one of the rumors of how they will monetize this, is they'll partner with companies like HBO, Showtime, and offer that premium content, those premium subscriptions, and Apple would take a cut of that revenue. I think that's the smart way to go. It's sort of how Amazon Prime does it. And the only challenge Apple has there is getting some of the partners to play ball. But I think they have the power of getting eyeballs, especially if they make their own original content free, right? You're going to have a lot of people interacting with that TV app, and that's going to be hard to resist for a lot of those premium channels. So I think they can pull it off. I think Apple can make that happen. And if that happens, I think the number of people interested in Apple's video subscription service would go up exponentially. But I don't know. What do you think about this? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And kind of while we're on the streaming content side of things, a quick little story about Apple Music and Google Home devices. There was a recent update to the Google Home app, and it started showing possible support for Apple Music. This got a lot of people excited because if you remember recently, Amazon and their Echo products added support for the Apple Music service, and it was looking like the Google Home was going to do something similar, although when people tried to activate it through Google Home, connection to Apple Music was not working. Well, Google this week confirmed through Bloomberg that the appearance of Apple Music, unfortunately, in the Home app was simply a bug. They say that the Google Assistant and Google Home apps share various settings for music services, and they accidentally opened up the Apple Music setting in the Home app by accident. Now, if you are into conspiracy theories at all, you may feel like, maybe they are actually planning Apple Music support, but are just not quite ready to announce it yet. It could be coming. I think it would be great. Apple seems open, especially given the Amazon deal, to making Apple Music available on other smart speakers and other devices outside of things like HomePod. So I'd like to see it happen. Anywhere they can expand Apple Music, I think, is a good thing. And they've had great subscriber growth on Apple Music. And I think they would want to continue that. And doing that sort of thing would enable that. Here's a little bit of follow-up from a story we covered last year, and unfortunately, it's not all that positive for some of the employees at Apple. Last year, there were reports that Apple had dismissed about 200 employees, actually over 200 employees, from their self-driving car project. This week, the San Francisco Chronicle confirmed those layoffs by reviewing a filing from the California Employment Development Department. It looks like Apple will actually be letting go about 190 employees. This will happen officially on April 16th, according to the filing. Apple is dismissing 38 engineering program managers, 33 hardware engineers, 31 product designers, and 22 software engineers from that program. Back in January, CNBC had reported that some of the groups were possibly being reassigned to other projects in other parts of Apple. It's not clear from this latest filing if that is actually happening, but it looks like Apple cutting back on that program, and we don't really know why they're making these cutbacks at this time, but Apple has gone through a couple different restructurings of the program, so it could be something as simple as that. Maybe they're refocusing on different areas and they just need fewer engineers in specific positions. So it's hard to speculate on what's going on, but it does look like, unfortunately, those layoffs are happening. Another thing that looks like is happening at Apple is they seem to be focusing more on software engineers than hardware engineers, at least if you look at some of their latest positions via Apple's job listings site. For the first time since at least the first quarter of 2016, the research firm ThinkNum says Apple has software engineering positions outnumbering hardware engineering positions. This does seem to line up with a lot of the reports we've been hearing recently that Apple is shifting focus from hardware to more services-based parts of their business, and that would naturally require a lot more software engineering. Don't panic, though. I don't think this means that Apple is forgetting about hardware or getting out of the hardware business. I think they have a big, healthy hardware engineering team at Apple, and they're going to continue to make great products and also combine those with a lot of these new services. So I think this is more about the growth into services and needing more software people than it is about downsizing their hardware engineering teams. And kind of speaking to that and to the future of Apple, at Apple's recent annual investors meeting, Tim Cook said that Apple has a, quote, long, great roadmap with a lot of exciting new products coming out. He says, in fact, a lot of those new products are going to, quote, blow you away. And he also used phrases like rolling the dice, which seems to imply maybe Apple taking bigger risks and kind of branching out into areas where they haven't been before, doing newer things. And I think examples of that could be things like autonomous vehicles or an autonomous vehicle service, and also some of the stuff that we know they're working on in augmented reality. We've heard rumors of virtual reality glasses, those sorts of things, maybe moving into gaming and streaming games. We talked about that recently here on the MacCast, and I'm sure there's a bunch of other areas we're probably not even aware of or thinking about. You know, who would have guessed that Apple would have entered the smartphone market, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? We probably wouldn't even have thought of that. And here we are today, and iPhone has become this big, mature product, and Apple's looking to the next big thing. And according to Tim Cook, it's going to be something amazing. And given Apple's history, I tend not to doubt it. He also did mention that Apple does have a goal of trying to reduce the price of the 2018 Retina MacBook Air. That kind of goes hand in hand with some recent statements made by Apple's chief operating officer, Jeff Williams, when he gave a speech at Elon University. After that, he was asked by a student about Apple's high prices and large profit margins, and basically said, look, analysts really don't understand the costs of what we do or how much time and care we put into our products. You know, Apple puts up giant entire laboratories, for example, for developing the Apple Watch, and does studies with tens of thousands of participants and licensed doctors and nurses, and that goes into the price of the product. So it's more beyond just the component prices, which is often what are looked at when analyzing those prices. But at the end, he says, you know, we are aware that, you know, people are sensitive to price, and we're not trying to create this elitist system. We want our products and services to be available to the widest variety of consumers. And so they are looking at ways to bring prices down, to make things more open to more consumers. I have to wonder about that a little bit. I talked about this on the iOS show. I think that's a great, noble statement and probably something that a lot of people want to hear. At the end of the day, too, though, I don't think there's anything wrong with Apple developing premium products and saying that they're a premium brand and pricing their products accordingly. At the end of the day, I kind of feel like they do need to make money in their business, and if this is what it costs to make the kinds of products that they make, then that should be justified as well. But certainly nothing wrong with trying to bring costs and prices down. It's just historically Apple doesn't do that at the cost of reducing profit margins, so that's a hard thing to balance out. So I guess I'm not putting too much faith in those prices coming down to the levels where, you know, every consumer can afford an Apple product, because historically that's not been the case. If it ever happened, would I celebrate it? Absolutely. I'd love to see everybody using Apple products and them being, you know, not cheap, but far less expensive. I just don't think that is going to happen anytime soon, just based on history. But I don't know. What do you think? Do you think Apple can bring prices down to a level where they're, as Jeff Williams put it, more egalitarian than elitists? I think they can do better, absolutely. And I sincerely hope that they do. And then finally, one other thing from the annual investors meeting that Tim Cook touched on was Apple's being on track to reach its target of doubling its services revenue by 2020 from its 2016 level of about $25 billion. And we know we've seen very strong services growth. We are expecting a services event to happen here in the spring in the next couple months, where Apple could potentially announce their new news subscription service, along with what I really hope they will announce, which is that new video subscription service that we're talking about. Whether that's a paid service or whether it's free, I don't really care. I would just like to see it announced and get a little more detail about what's going to be happening with it. I'm super excited about a lot of the shows. If you've been listening to the MacCast, every time we kind of talk about new ones that are rumored to be happening, I get more and more excited. Great sci-fi shows. There's some good documentary stuff, some great drama series. I'm particularly excited about Apple bringing back Amazing Stories from the 80s, along with Steven Spielberg. So I think that could be really, really cool. I'm super excited about that happening, even though it might not be until later in the summer or the end of the year before we actually see the original content. But I don't know. What do you think? Are you excited about Apple's future, or are you still a little bit tentative about it? I'd love to know your opinions. MacCast@gmail.com. Another thing that is also possibly expected from Apple toward the end of the month here, although it might be simply a quiet announcement on Apple's website, is some new iPads, some updated versions of iPads. And this week, MySmartPrice noticed two new iPad model numbers showing up in an Indian database that match numbers that we've seen recently in the Eurasian Economic Commission database. This was last month. These are typically a sign that Apple is getting ready to announce or at least put out new models of devices, and we are expecting spec bumps to the iPad Mini 4, so an iPad Mini 5, and the 9.7-inch iPad. We've talked over a lot of the details, though, about those on recent episodes of the MacCast, so if you want to get caught up, go back and listen to that. But it is also believed that Apple might update that 9.7-inch iPad model now to a new 10.2-inch display. And that could happen in the next few months, although it could also be a rev slated for later in the year, early next year. It's not really clear at this point because that would actually imply a redesign of the 9.7-inch iPad. And with the recent rumors, we're expecting pricing to come down a little bit and really it just be a spec bump with not many design changes. So we could be conflating or getting two rumors kind of mixed up here, but regardless, it is looking more and more likely that Apple will bump up a couple of the iPads here in the spring. So stay tuned for that announcement. I think we talked about a little bit last episode, the future of smartphones, and one of those futures that is starting to become a reality over the past couple weeks is foldable phones. Both Samsung and Huawei announced foldable phone designs. We kind of knew they were on the horizon. Flexible OLED displays have made it possible, and the question has started to become, when is Apple going to jump in on this game? Well, it looks like Apple has some concerns about foldable displays, at least if you look at a recent patent application filed by Apple. Now, we can't read too much into patent applications because these things happen all the time. They may or may not be representative of products or even things that Apple is thinking about for future devices, iPhones, Macs, what have you. But in this patent application, Apple is describing a process and a system to deal with a potential issue with foldable displays. And that is, in cold weather, those displays can become brittle. And as you might imagine, if you're folding them and bending them, you don't want them to be brittle. You want them to be nice and flexible. So one way Apple imagines dealing with that is by heating the displays in various ways. That could be little micro heaters and sensors that are in the device, or possibly by just lighting up the pixels in specific areas to kind of warm them up. The application also describes and notes issues for displays in cold weather where there are display adhesives and those having problems as well. So Apple says, hey, we could have a little screensaver in that area that might brighten up or provide brighter illumination along the bend or fold, warm that up a little bit, and that will possibly solve that issue. Another thing described in the application is possibly even locking the phone and preventing it from folding before it is safe to do so, maybe displaying a warning message and preventing users from accidentally causing damage to the device because it's too cold to actually bend. Now, I'm not really sure that's something you would want, but again, they kind of cover all scenarios in a patent application. And the technology of sort of having a sensor in some sort of auto-locking mechanism is kind of cool to think about, that it could actually kind of close itself up and say, nope, you can't open me right now. It's not safe to do so. So interesting things in the patent, and at least it kind of gives an indication that Apple is thinking about foldables. Steve Wozniak came out this week and expressed concerns that Apple could fall behind in foldables if they're not working on them. I think it's mostly because he really wants a foldable phone. He tends to be an early adopter. He likes technology and just really cool things. And let's face it, a bendable, foldable smartphone screen is just a really cool thing. They're cool to see. I think it's a bit early. Apple tends to not jump in early on this stuff, and we talked about this a little bit on the last episode of the MacCast. There was some concerns that because Samsung is one of the main suppliers of these foldable displays, that the fact that they are an Apple competitor might mean that Samsung holds the display technology back from Apple. This week, we've already heard reports that it seems like Samsung is already supplying various kinds of foldable displays to both Google and Apple, presumably for prototyping. Samsung, at the end of the day, yes, they're a smartphone manufacturer. They are also a display manufacturer, and they make foldable OLED displays, and they're hoping to grow that business significantly in the coming years. And to grow your business, what do you need? You need customers. Who are some of the biggest customers for displays and that display technology in the market? Of course, Google and Apple. So I can't imagine Samsung wanting to lock themselves out of that potential market. So I don't think this is going to be a problem. And like I said, they're already providing some flexible displays to Apple at this point, and there's no reason to suspect that they wouldn't continue to do so. So will we get a foldable phone from Apple at some point in the future? I think the answer to that question comes down more to what is the use case for that technology beyond just having a phone that then turns into a tablet, which is cool enough in and of itself, it might be, but Apple tends to be more about the use case and how the software and hardware work together. So I think we're a few years off. If Apple can justify it, then yes. My only concern would be that maybe the future is more screenless, that we are moving away from smartphone devices and tablets and into something else, say like augmented reality, voice interfaces, and those sorts of things. And so that could supersede the need for flexible displays at some point. Maybe there's some other technologies that come along. So only time will tell. Apple is not going to be an early adopter, though, I think, on foldable displays. I think 2-3 years from now, if they can make a use case for it, we'll start to see a foldable iPhone. But until then, probably not. Do you agree with me? Disagree? Shoot me some emails, maccast@gmail.com. Or even better yet, how about an audio comment? Let me know your thoughts. One other little patent application that showed up that was a little bit interesting. I'm calling it the Apple Power Glove, although it's more like the Apple Power Fingertip Covers. I don't know. The patent describes sort of little fingertip covers that are aimed at creating a more tactile experience for typing on an on-screen keyboard. It describes a, quote, system for modifying finger sensations during finger press input events. And basically, it's a little fingertip cover that goes over the nail and wraps around the sides of your fingers. And then as you're typing on a screen, it would gently sort of push in on the sides of your finger to flatten out or widen your finger pad, which will soften the impact that your fingers have on the screen, also provide a more tactile sensation like you were actually pressing in on a key. And the idea is to make it easier for you to type for longer periods of time on a touch screen. So that's interesting. I wonder if it could create a similar sensation for a virtualized or an augmented reality keyboard that might not even be present. That could be an interesting thing as well. And like I said, it is a future that I think Apple is exploring, right? The idea of not actually having a screen, more of a wearable computer that is maybe driving a display that is augmented reality or virtual reality in a set of glasses or contacts or something like that. So all interesting stuff. We don't talk about patents too much here on the MacCast because, again, a lot of times these are just ideas, they're thoughts, and many times they don't turn into actual products. But nonetheless, it's sometimes fun to take a little look at what Apple is doing in the patent space and try and deduce from that maybe what directions they're moving in as a company. So what do you think about future directions? Is there anything we're not talking about? I guess this is a great question for the community. Is there anything we're not talking about that you think we should be with regards for maybe businesses or technologies Apple should be pursuing for the future? You know, we've got augmented reality, we've got smart cars. Is there something else on the horizon that seems to make sense for Apple that maybe we're not thinking about? Let me know your thoughts. Often when we talk about the future of Apple Watch, one of the big things that we bring up is additional ways to track health and do additional health monitoring features. Well, this week, Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg says that Apple is testing a sleep monitoring feature for the Apple Watch that could be coming by 2020. He says that Apple has been using a sleep tracking feature for several months with testers at secret sites in and around its headquarters. The system could employ a special overnight low power mode that would allow it to do sleep tracking without draining the battery overnight. Then you could simply do a quick top-up charge in the morning, say as you're getting ready for your day, maybe when you're in the shower, pop it on the charger, charge back up, and away you go, get you through another day, and you'll have sleep monitoring on top of that. I know that actually is a pretty popular application for Apple Watch, and there's even third-party apps that kind of do some of this stuff already. Some of you have recommended those to us over the years, and I know several people who kind of sleep with their Apple Watch use tracking and monitoring programs and then do exactly that. They throw it on charger in the morning. It seems to work pretty well for a lot of people. But if you had a tweak to the Apple Watch design that was specifically designed for this, I think it could be even better. Adding this ability would bring the Apple Watch more in line with other sleep monitoring features on other fitness trackers. So something Apple is constantly competing with. and that market is definitely growing. Global smartwatch shipments are expected to increase by 40% in 2019, according to Gartner. So, of course, Apple's going to want to keep their lead in that space. I think this year, Apple accounted for almost 50% of all smartwatch shipments, although that is going down slightly as more of Apple's competitors enter the market with smartwatch designs. I know Fitbit recently added beyond, you know, have started adding models beyond just their standard fitness trackers. They've moved more and more into the watch space, and they do have some of these things like longer battery life and sleep tracking. So Apple, it seems, would want to get into that market, although they already are with an accessory. You may remember that Apple bought the company Beddit back in 2017, and you can actually get a little strip sensor that goes under your mattress, or I think maybe on top of your mattress. It goes basically in your bed, and you sleep. And while you sleep, it actually monitors that stuff through your iPhone and reports the data back to Apple's health app. So taking that technology and rolling it into the Apple Watch that you already have on your wrist seems like a good next step. I don't know what that means for the future of the Beddit product. I am curious. I don't have a Beddit, and I don't know anybody who does, but maybe some of you out there do. I'd love to get a little product review of it. So if you do have a Beddit, let us know your thoughts and opinions on it. Looks like subscription music services like Apple Music are having a pretty positive impact, at least on U.S. music revenues. The Recording Industry Association of America says the U.S. record industry grew revenues by 12% last year, up to $9.8 billion. The growth was driven by the popularity of paid music subscriptions, which were up 32% and now account for more than half of all music revenues at $5.4 billion. That's just paid music subscription services. Overall, when you count limited tier subscriptions and free streaming options, that accounts now for 75% of music revenue in the United States. Interestingly, music downloads now account for only about 11% of revenue, falling quite a bit, and actually means that physical sales like vinyl, CD, and cassettes actually sell more in terms of revenue than digital downloads. Those physical forms represented about 12% of all U.S. music industry revenues in 2018. So very, very interesting. Of course, Apple continues to build and grow their own Apple Music subscription service, now up to about 50 million paid users, at least as of January, and that growth continues. I have to say, I still am a very, very big fan of Apple Music. I enjoy it every single day. I know there's a lot of great services out there. Many of you use Spotify and really like that. Amazon Music, Google Play, lots of various options, and obviously it's having a positive impact on the music industry. The one thing I didn't see in these numbers, and I'd be curious to go look up, is how that compares to where it used to be in the heyday of physical sales like CDs, cassettes, and vinyl. So are we back to those levels? I think it's still down a bit at the $9.8 billion in 2018, but I have to go check my facts on that one. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple show sponsors, starting with Upstart. You know, applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, the loan companies, they make their decisions based off your credit score and history, and they really don't get to know the whole year. Well, now thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and your education in the form of a smarter interest rate. You know, years back, I made an attempt to go into business for myself, and it was really hard to get any kind of loan or investment capital to start my business because I really didn't have any business history, and my personal credit really wasn't built up yet. So it would have been great if Upstart had been there and available as an option back then, because maybe I would have had a little more choices. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which is biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. And that's because Upstart believes that you're more than just your credit score. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. You can do it in less than 2 minutes, and that check is not going to affect your credit score, which is a huge bonus. Best part, Once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day. Yep, the next day. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or to make a large purchase. You can free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/maccast to find out how low your Upstart rate is. That's upstart.com/maccast. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/maccast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the show. I'd also like to take a quick moment and thank Capterra. You know, years back in the mid-90s, I was working at this ad agency, and I ended up doing a bunch of IT-related stuff. So I was originally brought on as a pre-press guy, but more and more they found out I knew about computers, and they said, hey, we need some help with our IT. And so one of my jobs was to actually go out and find and recommend software and business tools for the company. And back then, the internet was in its infancy, just gotten started, so researching and finding information was really, really hard. It was incredibly challenging. Well, if I was doing that job today, I could just use Capterra.com. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solutions for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, you can discover everything you need to make an informed decision. You can search more than 700 specific categories of software, everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management software. It can get very specific. No matter what kind of software you need for your business, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution for you, and you can do it fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month. Visit capterra.com/maccast for free today to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. That's capterra.com/maccast, CAPTERRA.com/maccast, and a huge thank you to them for their support of the show. Going to kick off the feedback section of the show with a bunch of feedback. No surprise there. Actually, got two things that I want to talk about and follow up on, starting with our discussion about the upcoming Mac Pro, or what we hope will be the upcoming Mac Pro. Hopefully we'll see that in the next few months here, although it might be more this summer around Worldwide Developer Conference. But regardless, we do know that Apple has promised us a new Mac Pro in 2019. It is supposed to be modular, whatever that means. And that's where this speculation starts. And the question, right, what is a modular Mac? I gave you some of my thoughts and ideas on what I thought it might be like on the last episode of the Mac Cast, and I asked for some of your opinions, and Don came back with some of his thoughts. So here's what Don had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Don Cornelius. I just wanted to give you my impression of what a stackable modular Mac Pro might look like. And this is completely unrealistic, completely pie in the sky, and who knows if any of this could be real or possible. But the first thing I try and visualize is if you take a look at that Blackmagic eGPU that Apple's selling in its stores, the one that holds the external video card and connects to Thunderbolt, I think of that as sort of the case design. Imagine taking that unit, that eGPU unit, flip it on its side, so it's resting on its side. Now, cut it in half, because really what's going to happen is the fan and the power supply are going to, the fan's going to kind of disappear, the power supply is going to shrink a little bit. That's going to be what the base of this hypothetical Mac Pro is going to look like. And at each of the four corners of that rectangle, imagine those are physical connection points as well as heat exchange pipes. Now, take a very similar looking box and put that on top, and that's going to be the actual fan assembly. So the base of the unit is going to be a half height, the Blackmagic eGPU on its side, half the height, and it's going to have the motherboard with processor and memory. The top of the unit is going to be sort of a cap for the tower, where it's going to have large fans And the connecting points are going to be these heat exchangers at each of the four corners. In the middle, in the between the sandwich of the top and the bottom, are going to be the modular components. So imagine that you take another unit, the same sort of dimensions, and that's going to be one of your GPUs. And it's not going to connect over Thunderbolt. It's going to connect over regular PCIe through connectors in the bottom of the modular unit. Everything's going to sort of stack on top of each other and connect to a giant PCI bus running top to bottom. But the first modular unit could be an eGPU. And then you could stack another eGPU on top of it. And another one on top of it. Maybe you could go as high as four of these GPUs. Each of these modular units is going to have a sled in it. And you'll be able to slide the sled out from the front. And that will expose the connectors where you could put in any video card you want, any GPU. Now imagine that same form factor, but for regular hard drives. So a storage modular unit, where you could say you could stack 2 to 4 hard drives all sitting in a line on a board and on that sled and slide the sled into that modular unit. Same thing with SSDs. You could have an SSD, a bunch of M.2 connectors that you connect the SSDs into. And there would be a height requirement to all of this. It's not going to just stack like the Tower of Babel into heaven. So it'll have a certain limit. But whatever that limit is, it's going to allow for some crazy configurations. And just by the physical look of configurations, you can kind of see how many people are spending, you know, crazy amounts of money or crazy amounts of configurations based on the height of their towers, which could provide sort of incentive for people who are trying to outdo each other to have the tallest tower in the land, so to speak. So I just wanted to give some crazy ideas. I especially like the idea of the heat exchangers piping the heat up to the cap, which large fans on top. I think that would be very cool. Just a big old modular sandwich tower. Thanks.
Hey, Don, thanks for your feedback on that. Yeah, definitely the fan and the cooling and all of that sort of stuff. That is a challenge in a stackable modular design, right? Also, how those connectors go together. I think it's important to remember that Thunderbolt 3 is basically PCIe. So it's same technology running over an external cable. Of course, you could do it with a proprietary connector, and that makes more sense if the modules are totally stackable, right? You can have a connector where one goes into the other. The only thing weird there is, do you sort of define how things need to stack? Like, are all modules stackable? Can I put the processor only on the bottom? I would imagine there is some sort of base unit that's like the default unit, and then you build on top of that, which it sounds like you were thinking about similar thing in your design. But then can different modules stack in different orders? And then if so, then they're going to have connectors on both sides, I guess, except for the cap connector, which would just be the thing that tops the whole thing off. So I like your idea of this sandwich where you have sort of the two pieces of bread, right? The fan, the cooling unit as the top piece, and then the base unit, which would carry the CPU and logic, main logic board, memory, all that sort of stuff. And then you have different modules in between. And I think that kind of design could work. Once again, I think it complicates things a little bit because you could just have a single, right, large case where stuff just slides in and out of it. So why you wouldn't do that as opposed to the sort of modular thing, I guess more the fact that you could have a tower as small or as tall as you need it to be, which is a really cool idea. So love the thought process on it. Sounds very similar to what I was thinking. I've been thinking about this thing for years and years. I think a lot of people have. Why we've never seen truly a design like this happen before, I don't know. But the other thing that sort of is driving this in my mind is the images Apple has of the latest Mac Mini sort of being sandwiched or stacked together in kind of a raid. Now, in this case, you've got separate computer units, right, putting them together in sort of a render farm or you know, cobbling them together with, you know, network cables or however it might be, and you're really creating kind of a farm. But this would almost be like a computer that is in and of itself like a stackable farm, although it just makes a single super powerful Mac Pro when you're all done stacking things up. So great idea, some great concepts there. I can't wait to see what Apple does, because I think they have a chance to do something really innovative here and not just another, you know, tower server box. Although they've gotten themselves into trouble, you might argue, doing that same sort of thinking, right? Trying to rethink what a Pro tower is or should be, and that's what's gotten them into this position in the first place. So hopefully they don't make the same kinds of mistakes in thinking because of the time they've been taking and the number of pros they've been talking to in the industry. I don't think they are. I think they're being very, very careful about this, almost to a fault. I think it's almost being too careful, because again, I think they could have just put out a cheese grater Mac again with updated specs, and I think a lot of people would be very happy. But certainly that's not the Apple way, and I love these ideas and thinking. So if you have additional ideas, feel free to share those with us, and we'll keep this conversation going here on the MacCast. Another thing that we were talking about on recent episodes was just the Apple retail experience with the shakeup at Apple retail, Angela Ahrendts moving on, a lot of the changes that Apple has made with their Today at Apple and refocusing the stores on kind of being these town centers, this town center concept, a place you come hang out, maybe you get some training. I had asked you, what do you think about that? Are you enjoying it? What is your Apple retail experience like? Well, Gary sent in an audio comment specifically about this, and here's what Gary had to say.
Hey, Adam, Gary. Some feedback on the Apple retail. Maybe it's my perspective that's different versus what Apple is doing differently, but I don't enjoy going to the Apple store as much as I did in the past. I still like to just do a walk around and take a look and see what's new, but the overall experience, for me at least, has changed a lot. I know that when I go into the Apple store now, there's not as many nuanced items, like little hardware pieces that are unique to the Apple ecosystem that I might like to buy. There are some things there, but most of the time it's just a series of maybe a few things that are maybe very publicized. And so they're not really unique finds, where before they had a lot more unique finds, and then it became very standardized. I also preferred to go in and, you know, talk to one of the salespeople or talk to the people on the floor about cool things that Apple's doing or ways to use some of the products and services and the hardware. And now it seems like it's very rare to find that person. I have had those experiences, but it seems more likely now it'll just immediately go into like a sales kind of pitch, or you need to talk to this person if you want to talk about that. And it's not that great. In terms of the overall experience, like with the service and retail, having service perform is generally very good. I do like what you had suggested on the show, that do a walk-in appointment, because it's difficult to forecast out that many days. And even if you have, say, an appointment, generally what I've found is you get your appointment time, you go in, you check in, then they check you in, and then they say they're usually running late, and then they'll kind of page you or text you when it's available. So you're still waiting anyway. So to avoid using up your entire day, just start at the beginning, get in as early as possible so you can get in and out quickly. But I know that's not for everyone. So I generally now just go to using their online services or the service app on the iPhone, which I think works really great. It's easy. All your serial numbers are there. They don't have to ask you for details about your product, and you can get your answer quick. And I try to do everything I can through the online support or through the mail in terms of getting things repaired. So ideally, I would love to go to the Apple store more and find more of what I experienced previously back in the day. And I'm not finding that excitement anymore with it. Thanks.
Hey, Gary. Yep. It's definitely a different experience these days. A lot more crowded, I think, and that's what a lot of people react to. It has gotten, I've heard some comments, and I think this is a valid complaint. I've heard some comments that, you know, as cool as the classes that Apple is doing now, the sessions, the one-on-one, not every Apple store is really set up with the space to kind of take advantage of that. So a lot of times you're getting in there and not having a genius bar anymore, which they're really not. They're just kind of having you pick up your service appointment, you know, over on the side or something like that. A lot of times you're competing for space with a lot of those classes, those Today at Apple things that are going on. And that's a little bit of a different experience. I will second you on using the Apple support app. I think it is fabulous. I do enjoy, just like you said, if you've registered all your products through your Apple ID, having access to all of that information from inside the app. There is a lot of remote support, phone support, chat support, things that they can do outside of an Apple retail store for you that they can do pretty well over the phone, depending upon your issue and things like that. So I generally find if I don't have a hardware issue, if it's more of a software thing, something I'm having trouble with, I tend to like to use the online support, either through the app or just through Apple's website, whatever it might be. I do think that more and more, that's going to be a better place to do your first round of triage with Apple, because a lot of times, even if you go into the Apple store and wait for an appointment, they're going to have you walk through a lot of the same things that you probably could do at home for yourself on the phone. And the nice thing about doing them through Apple support online is they're going to have a record of that when you go into the store. Although I have heard stories from people in the community who have said, yeah, they walked me through all of these tests and checks online, ultimately had me make an appointment at the retail store. I went in and they had me repeat all of that stuff. That's a little bit frustrating, and I hope there's not a lot of that going on, but I have heard that from time to time. As far as finding just cool things at the Apple retail store, though, I think I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here. I think they have some really cool exclusive stuff, and I like how they've kind of broken it out into various sections. So they kind of have like the photography section with like drone stuff and cool photography stuff like gimbals and things like that. They have the what I call the toys section, which is all these cool connected accessories and toys that you can get for your kids. I love that kind of stuff. So maybe it's just the kid in me that really enjoys that. They've got the whole home automation section now. And then, of course, you have all the iPhone accessories and cables and adapters and things like that, along with more traditional things like hard drives and stuff like that. So I get your point. A lot of that stuff is available, say, at like the Apple Space and Best Buy or some other locations. But they do occasionally have some Apple exclusives as well. And so it's kind of fun to go in and check those out. A lot of times too, they'll have little demo models of that, so you can actually pick them up and try them out and talk to people about them. As far as like asking people at the Apple store about different projects and things that you're doing or things that you do with your Mac, I think, yeah, I would agree with you. A lot of that has trended toward the Today at Apple sessions. I think that's what that is all about, is recreating that experience for a larger group of people, less of that one-on-one experience, and maybe that's something that you're responding to. It was nice to be able to go in and just one-on-one, but Apple is so busy now, I think they are trying to sort of better control those experiences. And I think part of that is, okay, I'm the guy that's on the floor to sell you things. If you want to know more about using your iPhone for photography, we have a great Today at Apple session for that. You should go check this out, or you should sign up for this, and we have this available for you. So I get where Apple might be coming from there in trying to better control the retail experience, but it certainly has changed. And so the question becomes, does it need to change back? Does it need to go a different direction? And overall, I have to tell you, what I'm hearing from our community is that people like the changes at the Apple retail store. Many of you wrote in to say how much you've enjoyed the Today at Apple sessions, that you've taken advantage of those, and you really do like them. The Genius Bar experience, it does sound like that could be improved a bit, and I still maintain that maybe separating that from the actual Apple retail experience might be the best way to move that forward. I think they're trying to do that with pushing more and more people to the online support, but very often that's not what people are looking for. Consumers like that one-on-one service, which is why I think Genius Bars are often overloaded. So maybe if Apple could staff up, separate that from retail, get those into separate locations or separate spaces, they could improve the overall experience. Again, we gave the analogy, and I think this is a good one, of a car dealership where you have one side that's selling the cars, but then you have the service center that's a little more focused. Maybe they got some nice lounges, some chairs you can sit in while you wait. Maybe you can do things. They've got stuff up on the TV. Apple would have a great opportunity to show off some of their products in a different light in that kind of a space. And, you know, they could offer coffees. They could even have a cafe, like a support cafe would be awesome. You go in, you get a coffee, maybe you get a Danish, waiting for your appointment. You know, there's a lot of opportunity there. So they could really change up the in-store support experience if that's something they want to do. It's not clear if that's what they want to do, but I do find that interesting. So I'd love to hear more thoughts on this. And Gary, thanks for sending in your thoughts and opinions and sharing your experiences. Another interesting thing happened this week in the news, but it was something I wanted to talk about more as a community topic, and that is the idea of better security, or really more better privacy for our iCloud data. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is actually calling out a bunch of tech companies, not just Apple, over issues surrounding security and privacy, and specifically for Apple. Oh, by the way, this campaign they're calling Fix It Already. So they're kind of pointing out things that are issues within companies related to security and privacy, and they're saying, hey, let's resolve this. Let's get this solved. And so the one thing they called Apple out on was encryption of data in iCloud. A lot of people don't probably know this. A lot of us know that Apple encrypts our iCloud data, but sometimes people don't realize that specifically for things like iCloud backups, you have the encryption keys on your device, but Apple also has those encryption keys. So while the data is encrypted in your iCloud backups, Apple does have the ability or the possibility to actually decrypt that iCloud data. They say it's mainly for those situations where a customer might forget their password and want their data back, which I think is good. But it also means that if a court subpoenas Apple or there's a government request, they can provide decrypted data or decrypted versions of your iCloud backups, which is basically everything that's in your phone, or for the most part. We're going to kind of define what that data is in a second to let you know what is encrypted and what could potentially be decrypted. But I think this is a valid point for the EFF to bring up because, you know, Apple does a good job of disclosing how they protect this data or what data is accessible, what's encrypted, what's not encrypted. They actually have a great page on their support website. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But at the same time, they don't give the user the ultimate control over whether Apple has access to decrypt that data or not. The way it works right now is you either opt into iCloud and iCloud backups, and if you do, it works this way. If you want it any differently, then you're out of luck. You can't really use iCloud backups. You have to come up with some other solution. And there is a good other solution, and we'll talk about that here in a second. But I want to start off by just basically going through what can't they decrypt? So what is end-to-end encrypted in iCloud and in iCloud syncing, and what is the data that is protected that only you have access to and Apple can't get to at all? And that's things like home data, so your HomeKit stuff, what's happening with your smart home devices. HealthKit data, if you're using iOS 12 or later. If you're using earlier, it's different. Your iCloud keychain, so all of your saved accounts and passwords, those are fully encrypted and protected. Apple can't get access to those. Any payment information related to Apple Pay and those sorts of things. The stuff that is in your QuickType keyboard, so the stuff that you're typing, all those autocompletes and those sorts of things are protected if you're using iOS 11 or later, and I think most of us are. Your screen time data, Apple doesn't have any visibility into that. Any Siri information, so all of the Siri stuff that Siri learns about you over time, that's all protected. And with a caveat, messages in iCloud. And I say with a caveat because if you're using the messages in iCloud feature, this is the thing that lets you sync your iCloud messages between your devices. So if you get an update or you make a change on one device, it syncs across all your devices. If you use iCloud backup in conjunction with messages in iCloud, yes, the messages in iCloud is end-to-end encrypted, but the encryption key is also stored in your iCloud backup. And as we said before, iCloud backup is decryptable by Apple, which means they could get the encryption key for messages in iCloud. And with the encryption key, they could encrypt messages in iCloud. So Apple can recover your messages if you lose access to iCloud Keychain and your trusted devices, because they can decrypt your backup. So if you're using iCloud backup messages in the cloud, Apple would potentially have access to those. If you don't like that, you can turn off iCloud backup and a new key gets actually generated on your device and stays on your device to encrypt your messages and messages in iCloud. So Apple would not have that stored and they would not have access to that. So that one's a little bit more confusing, but hopefully that makes sense. All the rest of it, if you use iCloud for syncing, any other syncing outside of those things that I just mentioned, those are all decryptable by Apple. So that means your iCloud backups, your bookmarks, your calendars, contacts, Find My Friends data, Find My iPhone data, iCloud Drive, notes, photos, reminders, Siri shortcuts, voice memos, and email is all decryptable and accessible. Now, again, it's all stored encrypted on Apple's servers. It's just that if they were subpoenaed or if there was a government information request, they could potentially decrypt that data and provide it. Of course, you've got legal protections for that, at least in the United States. Your local laws and those sorts of things are going to apply in all of these scenarios. So what can you do if that's not good enough for you? If you want more protection, if you want more control and privacy over your data? Well, the number one thing is simply not use iCloud backup. Not have that stuff backed up to Apple's servers. Keep it all local. Now, that's not really convenient, but that's sort of your only option. As far as backups go, if you still want to have backups and you want to have your backups encrypted, you need to backup through iTunes. So connecting your device to iTunes, either wirelessly or through your Lightning cable, your USB-C cable directly to your Mac, and then turn on backup encryption on your backup. So those will be encrypted and stored locally on your Mac with the encryption in place. And then you can, because those files are already encrypted and stored on your device, you could back those up to a cloud service and they will be backed up encrypted. And that cloud service would not have access to your encryption keys because those would be stored locally on your Mac. Now, if you ever lose access to those encryption keys, of course, you're not going to be able to recover your data. And that's sort of Apple's point on this, is by having those keys, they can get people access back to their data. And personally, I feel like most people would rather have a little less security and privacy in their data and know that if they forget their password, if they lose their encryption keys, they lose their device or whatever, that Apple could recover their data for them. What's not always clear is that they understand that Apple has access to that data, and I don't know how Apple could do more than they already are about being transparent about that, because like I said, they do have an article on their support website that really lays this out in pretty plain English. It was how I figured out all this information I'm sharing with you. And so I think they do the best job that they can. But I can see where the EFF, you know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is coming from. Another thing you can do to protect your data and your backups locally, of course, is use whole disk encryption, something like FileVault 2 or some third-party software. And again, then don't sync to iCloud by default. You know, again, it might not be as convenient, but it certainly would be more secure. And if you want to secure things in iCloud, you would have to manually use some third-party software, something like TrueCrypt or something like that, to encrypt bits of data before it actually gets pushed into iCloud. So it would be almost double encrypted because you would have your own personal encryption on those files. Say it was something in your documents folder and you were using the documents in iCloud syncing. The trouble there is you're probably going to defeat the ability for you to actually read that stuff on, say, your iOS devices or to be able to decrypt it, right? You need those tools as well. So I know it gets a little bit confusing, but it would be nice if Apple would at least give us the option to encrypt our data on our own before it gets pushed up into iCloud and retain those keys only for ourselves, because they are generated on our Macs and our devices. It's just that they're also rolled up into those backups, and that's how Apple gains access to them. So Apple does have those keys. They could flip it around, allow us to generate those keys and just share that key between our personal devices, not have that up in the cloud, not have Apple have access to that, and that would give us better privacy. It's something that Tim Cook has said they want to do. I think Apple is moving in that direction. I think ultimately Apple doesn't want to be in the middle of all this. They don't want to deal with government information requests or requests from law enforcement to give them decrypted data. If they can get away from that, I think they would prefer to do that. So I think they're going to be moving in that direction. So, you know, the EFF, I think this is something Apple will fix. Why they haven't done it already, I think, is a great point. Now, staying with the topic of data security, data privacy, I did receive an email this week from Dan, and Dan is trying to help some family members move their data protection a little forward, move it into the modern age without compromising their current form of security, specifically for their financial data. So they have some financial data, and at the moment, the method that they're using to keep that data, that sensitive data, safe is by using some older technology that is not connected to the internet. Specifically, they have an old Mac SE where their financial data is. It's not connected to the internet, has no internet access whatsoever. So it's basically protected with more or less what would be an air gap. And in case you don't know what an air gap is, it's basically the idea of securing your computers on a network by putting them completely separate, so separating them. In this case, it's not even connected to a network, it's just an autonomous computer. But you get the idea, right? It's like, I have sensitive data on this, I'm going to isolate this network, and only the machines on this network have potential access to that data. It's not connected to the internet or the world at large, so therefore it's safe. There's an air gap, a physical disconnect between it and any potential attackers, right? So that's a great way to do security. Now, Dan has provided his relatives with a newer Mac Mini, and they want to transfer some of these files and data over, but they are rightfully concerned about data privacy and data protection. Dan said he himself uses tools like Veracrypt, but he worries that for these family members, it's going to be a little bit of a difficult solution, right? It's not the most straightforward thing. It can be a little bit confusing. He said he could possibly convince them to use things like Microsoft Excel, which would allow them to do password-protected Excel files, but then that would limit the data protection to just those file types. So he's looking for a more holistic solution. He says, you know, Apple encrypted disk images is something he played around with, but he was a little confused about how those work. Specifically, he noted that when they were mounted, those disk images were mounted, you could access and open any of the files placed in there without requiring a password. You didn't have to do anything. They just worked like regular files on a drive. And to him, that seemed like they were not secured. I'll clear that up here for you in a second, Dan, because that actually is secured. And similarly, he said he didn't think that doing full disk encryption like FileVault 2 was something that could work either. Well, actually, I think those last two, Dan, are probably very viable solutions for what you're trying to do. We covered this before a little bit, but I think it's worth repeating because I think a lot of people get confused about whole disk encryption or encrypted disk images in general, and I think Hollywood is a little bit to blame. You know, FileVault 2 is great. I use it on my Mac. It does a really good job of providing whole disk encryption and providing protection to your data, specifically if it were to get compromised physically, like your hard drives got stolen, your Mac got stolen, that sort of thing. I think the trouble for a lot of people is that it operates almost too seamlessly. And this is what I'm talking about with the Hollywood factor, because everybody's seen the movies, right? You're expecting encryption to look like that, which is, I go to hack data on a computer or try and get into a system and it's all garbled, right? It's jumbled up. It's gibberish. I can't really see it. It's encrypted. You know, that's the visual Hollywood version of encryption. And then I enter the data or I enter my password and magically things spin around and everything becomes clear and there's my data. It's decrypted, right? We see it encrypted. We see it decrypted. Well, modern computer encryption, decryption doesn't really work like that. And File Vault certainly doesn't work like that. When you're using your computer, when you're logged into the system, when you've authenticated into the encrypted system, you've essentially said, hey, computer, you have access to my data and my keys. That data is still encrypted, but now you can unlock it. You can access it. You can use it. And when you're writing data back to it, it's encrypted as well. And when you log out or shut down that system, access to those keys is removed and the data is sitting there protected, but it's still protected on the drive until you have put in your password in with the Mac. This is when you log into your system. So when you boot up your Mac and you actually go to the login, that's when you're granting access to the volumes. You're using Apple's core data technologies, and it's giving you that access. The data is still there. It's still encrypted on your whole drive. And as a matter of fact, if you've ever tried to turn off File Vault encryption, it's not really obvious up front, but depending upon the size of your drive, it can actually take days to decrypt the data. So decryption, encryption is not something that happens, at least strong encryption, not something that happens very quickly. So you are protected. That's just the way it works. Same thing with encrypted disk images. So you would need actual access to the computer itself, to those keys. Those keys, access to those keys are the key to gaining access to that decrypted data. So as long as you don't provide access to an attacker for that, then your data should remain safe. And that's why when you do turn on File Vault, something you want to make sure you do is set the system to require a password after your machine goes to sleep or when the screensaver turns on, and set that to as short a period of time as you're comfortable with. Also, anytime you walk away from your machine, so physical access becomes a big thing, make sure you lock it. As long as somebody can't get into your unlocked system, they shouldn't have access to your decrypted data. And so that includes someone coming in remotely over the internet, right? They're going to have to get privileged access to your system in order to access that data in a decrypted fashion, or your files in a decrypted fashion. So I think that's a good way to go. That's the way I would go, is just turn on File Vault, and that will protect every document and file that's sitting on that system. It will be encrypted and protected. So that is a good way to go. Now, again, if physical access is there, like you can't have your relatives, I would advise them not to set up the Mac to where when you boot it on, it automatically logs in. You want to go to a login screen, because again, until you authenticate, until you put in that password, you're not going to be able to get access to that data. What's great about that, though, is that means that systems like cloned backups and all those sorts of things, those will continue to work. The other thing to know is if you are using backups, you're going to want to look into systems that will also encrypt your backups. And there's many ways to do that. Again, we've talked about that on the MacCast in the past. So go back and look for those episodes, or just do some Google searching and you can figure out how you can decrypt your backups, your Time Machine backups, all those sorts of things. Because again, if someone were to physically steal your drive, I mean, it's great if you do whole disk encryption on your Mac's boot drive, but if you're doing a clone backup, your Time Machine backup, and you don't encrypt that as well, if someone were to steal one of those drives, they're going to have access to your unencrypted data, because that disk itself, that drive, is not encrypted. So that's a good thing to know. Just to finish up, also, you know, the air gap method, that is a great method. And you mentioned that in your email, Dan, right? That maybe I just give them another Mac that's not connected to their network. It's just sitting there next to everything, and they only do their financial information on that machine. It's fully separated from anything else. And I would say that works great until someone has physical access. What happens if someone breaks into the house and the Mac's sitting there and they just take it and steal it? You know, honestly, I feel like loss and theft are more likely places where someone might get targeted than just a pure, like, through the internet attack on a personal person. Now, again, this is different for things, you know, like big businesses or companies or those sorts of things. But, you know, as far as like day to day, do I worry about someone coming in through the internet into my specific Mac? No, not as much. You know, I think it's more likely someone breaks into my house and steals my Mac off my desktop and takes it away. And that's how they get access to my data. So I worry about that more. Obviously, not putting stuff into the cloud that is decrypted. That's another big attack point, right? So hackers are trying to get into Dropbox and, you know, any online storage accounts where you're storing data in the cloud, because those are vast repositories of potentially unencrypted, unprotected information. Now, if you're using a good service, hopefully that is protected and encrypted. The other thing you have to worry about, I think, in your home are things like unsecured network attached storage drives. Some printers have like storage, will store like data files of stuff you scan. If you know, it has a scanning feature or a copy feature, sometimes that's stored on a drive, and sometimes they have file sharing turned on by default. USB sticks that you have lying around, you know, those things, Internet of Things devices, Wi-Fi cameras that are connected to your Wi-Fi network. All of those things are a different story, because a lot of times those things have default passwords that people don't change. They're connected right to the internet. If someone can get into your home network, they are trying to access data and information off those things. So be aware of what things in your household you have connected to the internet, and take proper security measures on those devices as well. Like, I think that's really important. And then, you know, another great way, air gap, quote unquote, way of protecting stuff is, and you mentioned this in your email as well, using external drives or devices, USB sticks that have encryption built in. There's a lot of good options out on the market for thumb drives and USB drives, some with biometrics in them that automatically decrypt any of the, or encrypt and decrypt any of the data that go onto them. And those are great solutions, right? So you could just keep all your financial data and files on that. Me personally, for my taxes, my financial data, I do keep everything in an encrypted disk image. So I mount that when I need to work with those files and devices. And when I'm not working with them, I simply unmount it, and that whole disk image is encrypted. One last thing that I think people also forget about when they start thinking about security and privacy and home networks and stuff like that is firewalls, right? You don't need to have your entire system open to any inbound connection. By default, that's the way things are set up, because the idea is your router, your service provider, those should be providing some firewall protections, but you could put in a network firewall, or you can also just simply turn Apple's built-in firewall on your Mac. That's really easy to do. Go into Settings, Security and Privacy, and Firewall. If you enable it, just be aware that if you do have programs that need to communicate out and in, more importantly, in various ways, you might have to do some configuration, opening up some ports, tweaking of the firewall. So, you know, it adds a layer of complexity to what you're doing, but it also offers a lot of great built-in protection. And it's not that hard to figure out. It's a little bit tricky, but you spend a little time, do a little bit of Googling, and you can certainly figure it out. And at the end of the day, your home network, your Macs, your products are better protected. So we're not going to dive into it here. I guess we could make it a future subject if I hear from enough of you that you want to know more about using, configuring, and enabling Apple's built-in firewall. Maybe that's a great topic for a future episode of the MacCast. But thanks for sending in your question about how to kind of protect your data. Hopefully this helped you out. All right, last thing that I have for you today is a question from Keith. He was curious about iOS and specifically reinstalling the operating system. Something we talk about quite frequently here on the MacCast is doing clean installs. And so here's what Keith had to say, and here's what his question was about iOS.
Hey, Adam, this is Keith. I've got a comment and then a couple of questions. First, my comment in regard to the Mac Pro and the release of that. I'm in agreement in a sense that I like the old tower and the upgradable features. As a Mac Pro user, I've always like that ability to go in and to change things around and fix this component, that whatever. I hope that they go back to that in the new Mac Pro. And I also agree with you in a sense that I hope that they don't pre-announce something either, unless they say, okay, well, next month we're coming out with it or whatever for sure, but not this hopeful thing in the future. Say we got it and it's going to be coming out right now or shortly after that. But I do have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you in the community is to, I recently had a problem where I called the Apple folks and it was a very good experience, but I had a problem where my contacts weren't syncing and ended up having to reformat the phone or restore it from new. Traditionally, what I've done when I've upgraded my phone, I would take my old phone, do a backup on the computer, and run it completely right before I do my conversion to the new phone. Then I take my new phone and back it up from that and restore it from that previous one. And I've always found that to be very helpful. Made transition from one phone to another very quick and didn't have any issues with you know, trying to have to go through and restore every single app and all the documents in the apps and things like that. But when I ended up having to deal with this problem, the way that the Apple people redirected me to do it was to restore it as new. And it made me think about, you know, as you've talked about before in the past, when you're setting up a new operating system, you do a clean install, you know, erase everything and do that on a computer. But how often, I'm just curious, how often do you do that with your iPhone? When you get a new iPhone, do you set it up as a new and just reinstall all your apps new again over the top of that? Or do you restore it from a backup that you have on your iTunes? And if you do it as from a backup, do you ever say, okay, now I'm doing this as a new, or do you have a pattern for that? Or I'm just kind of curious. I'm kind of wondering, you know, now when I get the next phone, should I do a new install and start all over again? That makes me want to go to a longer process of upgrading, because it takes me a long time to get my phone set up, you know, because I have a lot of things on there that I like to do. And so I'm just kind of curious if you got some input on that, or if anybody else has some input. I would love to hear what you guys are doing.
Yep, I'd love to share that with you too, because I think this is a great question, and I think you're probably not the only one in our community that has this question, and I've wrestled with it from time to time as well. Right, where I've landed most recently is I almost never do and erase and set up as new on my iOS devices. And even more and more, I almost never am doing clean installs with my Macs. I have to tell you, I think Apple's gotten pretty good at providing over-the-top updates for the operating system, both on the Mac and on iOS. So the short answer is I only do a clean install these days when I know that I'm having a lot of issues and problems with my machine. If it's little finiggly things that are just annoying, I might not even do it. And as probably testified by how long it took me to upgrade to macOS Mojave because I wanted to do a clean install. So I wasn't in any rush. Or I guess I skipped High Sierra is really what it was. Like, I never upgraded to High Sierra because I never wanted to deal with the problems. I knew I was overdue for doing a clean install, but that was because I was having all kinds of issues with my current system. So I just wanted a clean slate to kind of rule out any weirdness that might be going on. And I think it's similar for iOS, at least for me. So I almost always just do a straight over-the-top upgrade. And if I need to erase and restore, I always restore from a backup, either from iTunes like you do, which I think is great, or more frequently now, I'm just using my iCloud backup. So that's happening automatically. I've already got it good to go. Although if I do know that I'm going to do a full erase, I will go on my device and initiate an iCloud backup just so I make sure I have all the most recent stuff from my system. And then I will do the erase, and then I will restore from my iCloud backup. And it gets me back up and running, I wouldn't say quickly, but more quickly than if you're doing the erase and setup is new. Because with the erase and setup is new, as you pointed out, you've got to get all of your apps back on there. You're doing all of your reconfiguration. And oftentimes I found that certain apps, especially if they're not syncing their data to the cloud, you can potentially lose data in apps. And you'll have to go to something like iMazing, which is really cool for getting back, you know, data from a backup, something like that, if you need to get specific app data that maybe doesn't come back when you're doing a setup as new. So I don't like doing the setup as new thing as much anymore. I agree with you. If you're creating a local iTunes backup, one bit of advice I would give you is make sure that you check on the encryption option, because that way it will save your health data, your network data into your backup, and you're not going to have to rebuild those or potentially lose that data. So make sure you're doing that. And like I said, in general, I only do a backup and restore as new when there is a really big issue. Now, hopefully, Apple support walked you through all of the other options for kind of resetting your sync data for your contacts before they took you down the path of completely setting up your iOS device as new, because it seems like an odd fix to me. Like, unless you were having a really big problem where the other forms of fixing it weren't working, I would not have advised you to do that. So because we're just having this conversation, I want to share with folks, and it does come up quite frequently, hey, my contacts aren't syncing properly, my iCloud data is not syncing properly, how do I fix this? And generally, the place that I start first is just with logging, or not logging in and out. I was going to say that's later. Just start by, of course, restarting the application and completely restarting the application. So bringing it up in the app switcher, swiping up on it, make sure that it's completely closed out, and open the application back up. That's like step one. Step two would probably be rebooting your device, you know, so like hard rebooting, hard resetting the iPhone, quitting the application completely and then reopening it after the hard reboot, making sure that you've basically cleared everything out of memory. See if that doesn't dislodge the syncing or get it, the syncing working again. And then if that's not working, really, the fix that I found works most often for people is simply disabling or turning off that sync feature in iCloud. Right? So go into iCloud. If it's just your contact syncing that's not working, turn that off on the device that's not syncing. It's going to prompt you and ask you, do you want to delete this data from the device or you want to keep the data on the device? Which one you choose really depends on your confidence of the data. If you know that all of the data that's in your device is also up in iCloud, then you could choose to delete the data from the local device. More often than not, though, the one I choose is to keep the data on my device. Because what's going to happen when you turn syncing back on, which is the next step, is that it is going to just try and sync up that data. So it'll take everything from the cloud, compare that to what's on your local device, the stuff that you kept, and we'll try to sync that back up if the syncing starts working again. And like I said, almost every time I've had somebody do this, it dislodges whatever the problem is and it starts syncing again. You may have to turn it off, turn off iCloud syncing for that, reboot, and start again. If that doesn't work, the more extreme version of this is completely logging out of your iCloud account on your device and then re-logging back in and kind of setting everything back up. Another tip to try is just resetting the network settings on your device. So go into Settings, General, Reset, and click the or tap the Reset Network Settings option. If you do this, just be aware you are going to have to re-enter your Wi-Fi passwords, your network settings, and all that sort of stuff. But sometimes it can just be that network connection that something's gone wonky with, and that's why iCloud isn't syncing up. So you have all of these other things you can try. Another tip that I often give people, and this seems like a weird one, but it comes up from time to time, and this is just good general advice for anything where you're working with your Apple ID, especially when it comes to syncing. So whether you're doing home sharing, whether you're doing iCloud syncing, is make sure that all of your devices that are in that sync, both your iCloud account, your iCloud.com account, your Apple devices, your Macs, they're all using the same Apple ID for iCloud. And this most often comes up for people who've had an Apple ID for a long time. So maybe you have a .Mac address, a .me Apple ID and a .iCloud ID, so at iCloud, at Mac.com, at me.com, and they're all tied to the same Apple ID account. Make sure that you're using the same version on all your devices. So, don't use iCloud.com on your iPhone and at Mac.com on your iPad and at me.com when you're logging into iCloud. Make sure that you're consistent and you're using the same email address across the board for those logins. I don't know why that makes a difference, but I've seen it make a difference, at least for me. And that could be a little tinfoil hat stuff. It could be a little voodoo, rubber chicken waving. I don't know. I just know that I think if you're consistent across the board, Apple does a little bit better job of resolving that when things sync. So you have all of those things that you can try as a very, very last resort. If you've tried all of those things and your syncing still isn't working, that's when I would recommend doing a full backup of your iOS device, doing an erase and restore. I don't necessarily wouldn't do the setup as new, do an erase and restore and see if that fixes thing. And then if that doesn't work, then do the erase and setup as new. So erase and setup as new, really in my mind, is an absolute last resort. It's like things have gone so bad, I can't figure this out any other way. I've tried and exhausted every other way I know to fix this issue. I'm going to go ahead and set this up as a new device. And that is like the clean install of iOS, right? That's how you do it. And just like a clean install on Mac, it's a lot of manual recovery of data from that point, right? You're starting with this fresh system, you're putting on all your apps, you might have to sync some of the app data back. It's a little less extreme because, things like your email are going to come from your IMAP accounts and things like that. But overall, it's a process, right? It's not easy. And more these days, I don't think we need to do it. And same thing on the Mac, right? So it's fewer and far between, but that's just my thoughts on it. I'm sure others in the community have their own thoughts, and I'm sure they will share those with us. So if you want to do that, shoot us an email or send us an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. The MacCast is also supported by you, members of the MacCast Patreon community. If you'd like to directly support the show, you can check out the Patreon by visiting patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all my Patreon supporters. It really, really does go a long way to helping, just cover the costs of the show, and also just is really appreciated by myself and my family. So thank you, all of you who support on Patreon. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you, your comments, your questions, your emails. Keep those coming. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.